Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Hello, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Chris. Thank you for joining me today. It's really an exciting day here in the studio, and I'm excited that you've all tuned in to be a part of this conversation today. And we do gather every Tuesday to talk about those things that impact our lives on every level: our mental health, our well-being, our joys, our struggles, our love and our laughter, our heartaches and victories. And usually we talk about it together, but today we're going to do things a little differently. Instead of taking calls today, we're going to be doing just an in-studio conversation, but you'll still be able to be part of the conversation as always. You can join us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, through our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com or listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org. We're under the News and Talk tab right at the top there, right at the top. A conversation with a reluctant therapist. We'd love to hear from you. Love to have you participate in these conversations as you feel inclined. But today, I've been thinking a lot about what's going on in the world, as I hope we all are at all times. And I think one of the most pressing things that are going on, that's going on right now, is the tragedy in Nepal, the earthquake and aftershocks, earthquakes, the devastation, the lives that have been lost, the historical memories that have been lost, the changes that are going on across the world that for most of us we can't relate to at all. And I'm thinking about this conversation, this topic, one, because my heart goes out to the people there that are suffering and having to face now the daunting task of rebuilding, but also because I have a personal connection to this region, to this area. I have a beloved cousin who has lived there for 30 years, and to know that she and her family are in the heart of this has been really difficult, to feel that they're having this life experience that I cannot relate to at all except through pictures or through the tellings or the stories that I'm hearing. And so I've been feeling this experience kind of through the eyes of my cousin and her family. And so from the reluctant therapist's perspective, I think about the mental health of all of us here who are trying to understand and comprehend what is going on across the world when it has nothing to do with our day-to-day, right? When our concerns here are the drought, which are huge and life-changing. Our concerns here are weather patterns in the Midwest that are, you know, just destroying family homes and legacies. And we have things that we are concerned about in this space, and then we're being asked to be concerned about things that are happening in a land that most of us know nothing about. And then it's easy to forget that others are suffering or in need, because it's hard to really imagine a world that we have no personal experience with. So when disaster strikes, we tune into the part of the story that resonates most with our worldview, right? Maybe we visited there, or we know someone from there, or we have some sort of tie, a vantage point that we connect to. But if we can't connect on a personal level, it's easy to have our consciousness drift away from that pressing need and be replaced by the more pressing demands of our day-to-day, of our own responsibilities and struggles. And it has nothing to do with lack of empathy or feelings or sympathy or care. It's that we cannot sustain in our human psyche the ability to hold pain and suffering that's not in our current worldview. So today, I'm able to bring you a personal take on the worldview of those who are in Nepal and struggling and suffering and also thriving and growing and loving, because my cousin Carol Dunham is here visiting the States for a while. And I was able to bring her into the studio to have a conversation one-on-one about her family and her experiences in Nepal and what's going on. So welcome, Carol Dunham.
Welcome. Very glad to be here.
Carol Dunham is a medical anthropologist by training. She's also a Buddhist chaplain who focuses on working with trauma and resiliency, which I'm sure is being called on at this time more than ever. And also with her family, she's been leading, they all lead medical expeditions into Mongolia and the Himalayas for National Geographic as kind of a family adventure and experience. So Carol, I'm so excited to have you here in the studio. It's so wonderful just to see you from a familial point of view, but also because of what's going on in your part of the world, I really would just like to hear what you're experiencing, what this has been like.
Well, obviously, I mean, being shook up from the core of one's being, many of us were not surprised. We had always been prepared, most of the Westerners who've lived there, that one day an earthquake was highly likely or possible. And yet what I think has been most challenging is we've had so many aftershocks that it's been very, very difficult to recover from it. We were just moving out of the recovery time period, the emergency, and that we could move on to reconstruction. And then we were hit by a second quake. And the aftershocks are continuing. And so what that means is that on a physiological level, in terms of trauma, every time the earth shakes, everyone has that memory in their body, and the fear, the uncertainty is triggered in a very, very deep way. The sympathetic system of almost 8 million people who have really been in fight or flight for this long is becoming exhausted. And what really is challenging right now is the caretakers, the army and the police who have been having to rescue people out of collapsed buildings, the hospitals where the doctors are, et cetera. They're exhausted right now. And what's interesting is for the first time, everyone and all of the relief missions that are going out to try to bring tarps and food out to very rural and remote areas are seeing whole communities that have been shocked and dazed and stunned and trying to find what is the best method of working on trying to rebuild that resiliency. But I would like to share one thing that I thought was very powerful that you talked about in your introduction, which is sort of, you know, how can we sustain a caring, or how do we relate to it? I can honestly say that the power of the, you could say, the love or the concern for Nepal is immense. It is considered, like Haiti, a very challenged country economically. The poverty levels are extremely high, and yet the spirit is something that people have always been attracted to. It's made it a high place for tourism. And so there's been, the small sites, the GoFundMe, crowd campaign, fundraising, it's a record in terms of small individuals trying to raise funds to try to help in any small way. And what we've seen is an extraordinary grassroots explosion of civil society actually getting together on their own and independently, gathering rice, gathering tarps, gathering trucks, and going out to try to fill the void of a dysfunctional government. And as the larger aid agencies are a little more slower at moving in. And so there's been something quite extraordinary in terms of union and bonding coming out in a very tenuous. We came out of a civil war, a conflict, and now we see some of the urban elite moving out into the rural areas trying to help in a very beautiful way. And what I would urge is anyone who has an interest, it's some of these smaller grassroots organizations that really show a political potential as well in Nepal of hope, and are showing, using social media, linking, connecting, clustering of just good-hearted people doing good things. What we've been trying to encourage is, because this is a long-term story, and people are still in shock. Mm-hmm. We're coming monsoon, the rains are coming. We're all very concerned because there's a lot of elderly that live in these rural mountains, and their ability to make it through this summer is very difficult. And trying to rebuild, which will really mostly happen after the rains, but making sure they survive through the rains is a really key issue in these next couple of months, is what's so important, we feel, is if you can find and connect to one village, this is really what we're trying to work mm-hmm. with, is telling people some of the larger agencies, there's a way to give, and wherever you give, for the most part, you can have impact. And really thinking for yourself, do you really care about education? We've had over 14,000 schools destroyed, for example. Are you concerned about the health? Are you concerned about shelter and food? For all of us right now, shelter and food combined with the health to make sure is really kind of our main focuses at this time.
So what you're talking about is to make it personal, to make your giving and your care personal to one village that you can connect to and watch the progress of the growth. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I'm joined in the studio today by my guest and my cousin, Carol Dunham, who has been a resident of Nepal, Kathmandu, for 30 years. And she and her family were right in the heart of this earthquake when it happened. And we're talking about tragedy and growth and resiliency. And maybe we can back up and you can just talk from a personal level of what this was like for you and your family when the quake hit. What was going on in your life? What brought you to Nepal, Kathmandu, and then to the point of the earthquake?
I first came to Nepal, and I ended up in a Buddhist nunnery, and I was very interested in how the Nepalese live their religious traditions, their spiritual traditions, and particularly the women. I was very interested in Hindu and Buddhist ideas. And really right now, this is the huge treasure chest they'll be able to draw on for developing their own resiliency tools. Many of Nepalese are saying, you know, we're not so sure that your psychological tools will work for us, they say. Whereas right now, many disaster relief trauma therapists are much more interested in somatic therapies and therapies that work with the body and work with the sympathetic and parasympathetic, which means to move us from the fight or flight into more calming places or states. And so this is really they have a very rich heritage or tradition that they can draw from. And I was interested in that even 30 years ago. There's a lot from the Buddhist and Hindu heritage they can draw from. For my family, we were scattered. I was lucky enough to be on a road on a motor scooter, and I thought that the scooter was drunk or something because it was almost falling over.
And what time of the day was this for you then?
We were very lucky. The quake occurred in the middle of the day and on a Saturday, and if it had happened at night, if it had happened on a weekday, the casualties would have been far, far greater. We're very, very lucky, especially in terms of school children, et cetera, because those buildings really collapsed in huge ways. So right now, I think for my family, my son was down on the first floor, and he knew what to do because he'd been, as a young child growing up there, they always had earthquake drills. And he went into the door frame until it went down, and his father did everything he wasn't supposed to do and ran down the stairs, and then they ran outside. And there was a profound camaraderie where I was. We know that our neighborhood very, very well. We live right near a small pond, which was called Ganapokri, which means the pond of the sacred necklace. A goddess lost her necklace in there and has never found it again. And so we all gathered there as a community in a real beautiful sense of camaraderie. And there has been some very beautiful linking that has occurred out of this. But I think recognizing how to move the nervous system of almost an entire nation, and particularly those that have been most involved in the rescue and recovery, be they the police, the army, the doctors, the teachers, the social aid workers, grassroots, helping them to be restored for the long haul that we're going to need for recovery is absolutely essential at this time.
Because it sounds like, I mean, from just your family's perspective, so your son and your husband were home, you were out on your motorbike, and then your other son.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that. My other son was, he was in Oman with his school on a track meet, and I honestly think it was harder for him. Mm. And that's where I really relate to anyone who's listening to this that has a link or connection with Nepal and how their heart feels when you see the devastation of the earthquake and those images. I honestly think it's almost harder to be to not be there. I actually had in the moment even, thank heavens, where, you know, I'm here at this moment in time. And my son, he had to wait 4 hours where he didn't know. We have an old house. He couldn't get through to us. And it was, I think, very, very, very difficult for him. And it was, he felt very relieved, ironically, to fly back the day after the earthquake. He had to fly around for 4 hours because of the congestion at the airport from all of the aid work coming in. And then to then start to experience aftershocks together in a certain way, I think for him, he felt like at least we're together as family as we move through this. But I think that really, it's harder for people that are not always there. Mm-hmm. And I think really, if you can make any kind of contributions, the level because we have this devastation on top of the earlier devastation of poverty and the necessity to kind of see it as a multiple layers, we're already looking down the road at how can we replenish the animal stock, the livestock. Mm. And I think what we've seen is some extraordinary examples of resiliency. We've seen in certain communities where people on their own, they're just saying, you know, give me a piece of tin or give me a tarp and I'll do the rest. And they're doing it. Because Nepalese have had to live for a very long time without a lot of government intervention of any kind. But there are communities that are cut off. And now with the roads, there's been landslides and trying to figure out which communities are most vulnerable and that there might be some massive migration movements that mm-hmm. will potentially come down and out of this. So that how as a communities will work on this. Nepal is ethnically very complex. We have over 76 different ethnic groups, depending on how you cut or slice it. And what that means is that actually there are very different kinds of coping mechanisms in different cultural contexts there. And the sensitivity and the awareness, the listening, and really recognizing that they have those tools inherently within them, I think is the most critical point for anyone interested in trauma and resiliency who wants to go over there, that rather than just simply trying to apply a method or a tool, first listen deeply and ask them and remind them, and so we can mirror back and resource their own internal resources.
You're listening to Carol Dunham. She's a medical anthropologist, Buddhist chaplain, and expedition leader with her family in Nepal. She's been a resident for 30 years. And we're in studio today talking about life post-earthquake and life with aftershocks and the continuing healing that needs to happen, not just for the communities and not just for rebuilding of ancient sites and temples, but also to help individuals to find ways to cope, because the fear of aftershocks or the next quake or the other shoe dropping makes it very difficult to find any sense of grounding or normalcy, because your fight or flight system is consistently activated. So it's hard to sleep, it's hard to eat, it's hard to think. And so dealing with the very human cost of the day-to-day functioning after such a tragedy is also a struggle. We're doing things a little different today. We're not taking calls. We're just going to be talking in studio, but this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And Carol, to continue keeping it very personal, can you talk a bit about how your immediate neighborhood was impacted and the people you are close to in your just immediate area?
Well, we were very blessed. We live in actually the oldest part of Kathmandu, and yet in terms of inhabitation of it. But there are very sturdy buildings in the area that we live in. So our area was less impacted. We only heard at the end about all of the massive devastation that had occurred inside in the oldest parts of the city or the bazaar itself.
So the picture that we've seen of ancient sites and the collapse were not in your immediate neighborhood?
Not in my immediate neighborhood. And so as a result, but my husband and son, my husband is a photographer and my son is as well. They're a team. And they went out immediately to try to find out what was going on. And so I have to work as a mother, because I had my son who's 19 witnessing, you know, and then deciding that it was, rather than take photographs, he was so very, very disturbed to see photographers that later we would call scavenger photography, who would say, you know, can you hold that body there for a minute as they're trying to pull them out of the rubble? And it disturbed him so greatly, because he, you know, dropped the camera then and tried to help. Is I said to him, you know, you don't have to be like that. You can decide actually that, make the intention in your heart that every photograph that you take, that you have made some kind of connection with a person, and that you hope that you can mirror back their inner resources and resiliency to them. And then you can ask permission if you could take their photograph. And you see that then there's benefit perhaps both ways, in a reciprocal way, your ability to sleep with yourself, and that you have at least hopefully mirrored back to something to someone. So he experimented with that. He went out to Bhaktapur, a beautiful Hindu city that was had profound devastation. And people were in shock and trauma, crying or sitting there just stunned on top of homes. And he found it was very, very powerful to put away the camera and to first make connection and to first ask questions. And he asked, you know, well, why do you think this earthquake happened? And you know, many from a traditional and a spiritual religious perspective here, many felt, they said, well, it's, you know, that it's the accumulation of our sins, of not treating each other properly. In other words, when the relations between other humans become soured, when we're greedy and we're ignorant or full of desire, this is Mother Earth herself, Prithvi herself, you know, shaking us off. There, amongst the Newars, this was a Newar town, they're an ethnic group there, the women have an old tradition. They take their thumbs and they push them into the ground and they go, ha, 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 to try to hold down Mother Earth from moving. And there was, as we look across, there's a real complexity of it's almost like there was a cosmological earthquake as well, a shift
within the communities,
within different communities. And now with this second earthquake, and this second earthquake was almost like taking someone who had, you know, had been punched and was on the ground and then kicking them. And so it's almost like people are trying to find their breath again. Mm-hmm. And but do not underestimate the power, the strength of the Nepalese. They're very, very powerful and resilient people, and they have their own tools.
So talk about that resiliency, and what do you see as, because, you know, the pictures that we're seeing are of destruction, because our media likes to only talk about the things that give us shock and awe here, right, that capture our attention. But what are some of the positives that you see happening now just amongst the people themselves?
I've lived in Nepal for 30 years, and I can't even begin to tell you the beauty of seeing it's in the youth. And it's in the young and the college-age kids particularly, banding together, using social media. We're having our own sort of, Cairo moment, and let's hope it doesn't fizzle out, because people are clustering together. They're making alliances. They're working together. Oh, you have the rice. Oh, can you help me get some tarps? Oh, you have the truck. And let's all go out together and try to help. Now, it's chaotic, but the heart is so in the right place. And the potential of that urban and rural divide linking together, and the unity of that, even within all this cultural and ethnic diversity, which has caused, you know, even a civil war conflict in the past, there is perhaps some, you know, a small hope for things to change. It's a very tenuous one. It's a very fragile one.
Well, and it sounds a little bit like what we see here in the United States with our young millennial generation, that they've been raised to have a whole different experience with diversity, that they just are together. They work collaboratively well. They don't label or distinguish. And so it sounds like a little bit of that same thing in Nepal, that even though there's 76 different cultural backgrounds, for the young population, they don't see the differences. Is that what you're saying?
Well, there's still a lot of the grouping around people, feeling comfortable working together, but now they're making also those different bonds. And that's really powerful. What we're also seeing is extraordinary innovation of folks are saying, okay, well, if we're going to rebuild, because, you know, the heritage loss is also something profound. Mm-hmm. And so when we're looking at just shelters of saying, we're seeing people that are saying, okay, well, if we make a tin like this, but then here's how we can adapt it, and oh, we can use some bamboo, and trying to say, they're not waiting around, saying, oh, well, we're just going to wait for handouts. There's some incredible innovation, people just saying, okay, well, let's see what we can making do with very, very little. And that's really quite extraordinary. But at the same time, you know, the UN has only been able to raise $22 million out of, I think, $145 million that they're hoping to gather. So that it will require, I mean, we've lost 30 years of development. So the real complexity is the long haul of what it's going to take in reconstruction and rebuilding. And so to really make a single impact on one person's life or on a small community life of saying, I will dedicate and try to see what kind of change, I really think for the long haul is something very, very profound.
So what do you see for the rebuilding of the heritage sites? Is this something that becomes religiously divisive, you know, or do you see that there's a lot of support to put, if there's limited resources for rebuilding, is everyone going to want to put those resources to rebuilding?
Thank you for asking that question, Bits. So many of the religious sites that are in Kathmandu are related to a very specific ethnic group and has a great sense of history. One of the sites that went down is called Kastamandap, which is what this capital, Kathmandu, is named after. And ironically or tragically, it was people that were there for blood donation at the time, you know, really wonderful people inside the temple when it collapsed. So I would hope that a lot of those sites would be something that we as a community, as a global community, would see that it's part of our global heritage, mm-hmm. and that we would all work together to try to and what's going to be interesting is to see, do they want to restore it exactly as they were, or are they going to say, no, we're going to create. It's been extraordinary to see them pulling out the deities out of the rubble. And really, it's a time now in terms of trauma and resiliency of finding the Atma, as they call it, or that inner, what is the inner sacred or divine, now inside themselves. That's the deity they have to recover from the rubble, and each and every single individual in Nepal. And the beauty of Nepal's diversity has been in its diversity. They used to always say, we may not be rich, but we're very rich in deities and gods. So I believe that that's the rich resource that they're going to be able to pull from in cultivating their resiliency and returning back. In terms of the temples, my prayers would be is that we can, all of us, work together. Whereas right now, the main issue is just making sure people have shelter and food.
And to not get too focused on the high profile piece, because as you're saying it, I don't know if we didn't talk about that Nepal leans heavily on the tourist trade, right, to help buoy the economy. And so there seems to be a lot of pressure to rebuild those tourist-based sites before rebuilding houses and schools and things to maintain. So how do you balance those two pulls?
Well, I think what's going to be interesting, and I hope to be a part of that, is the trekking agencies, the tourist ministry in Nepal, they're realizing they have to completely reconceive what tourism will be and means in Nepal. And so a lot of people are posting, for example, on social media sites, the best thing you could do for Nepal is to come and is to visit. I would say wait till the fall if you can, because by then, right now, engineers are going around and assessing. I would say check and make sure that the place you're staying has been checked and it's earthquake proof. There's no quakes, etc. Pokhara, for example, which is a great tourist destination, receive very little devastation. But we're looking at volunteer tourism and looking at, you know, any young strapping people that are willing to move rubble around. We have a lot of elderly in these communities. There's a small community where you can possibly try to help people to rebuild their lives from the rubble. And there's not a lot of people that's a very small kind of tourism, granted, but it's it could be a wonderful way for people to help to assist with the economy and the regrowth and the rebuild for those that are connected and love Nepal.
and find a way to tap into their own heart of wanting to give and be a part of Nepal's rebuilding and the cultural heritage that, as you said, it's a worldwide cultural heritage that people are drawn to. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. We are in studio talking today to Carol Dunham about life in Nepal post-quake, and we'll be back to continue this conversation. Thank you for tuning in this afternoon to this conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I am overjoyed today to have in studio my cousin, Carol Dunham. We actually grew up together through college, spending a lot of time in our family events and family activities, and then we kind of went two different directions. Post-college, Carol found herself living in Nepal, Kathmandu, married, and growing her family and her life and her career. And then I was here. I have been here. So to come back together after 30 years has been a really profound experience. And unfortunately, around something as tragic as the earthquakes, but I'm just so happy that you're here. So thank you for joining me in the studio. And if you could talk about this experience with the earthquakes and the change, because your work as a medical anthropologist, but also your work with National Geographic and leading medical expeditions into Mongolia and the Himalayas, your livelihood, as you and your husband have created, is kind of deeply vested in the health and well-being of the economy and the people of Nepal. So could you talk a bit about the work that you and your husband, Tom Kelly, do and how your life will change from this point? Or do you even know yet? Because it's still so new.
Yeah, I think I think all of us in the Kathmandu Valley are talking about how we've been quaked, and I don't think I'm alone in all of us. The ability to sort of return back to normal. I think we're going to all talk about pre-earthquake and post-earthquake. Very profound way. The earth has shifted and moved, and I think our lives are going to move and shift in the same way. My personal life is been a woman of many hats, and I've had many phases. I've done many films in Nepal, focusing on history and culture, actually, ironically, on the geology of Nepal as well, with National Geographic, goddesses in Nepal, and how does culture, when political social change occurs, how do rituals change to adapt to it, was a film, one film that we were all involved in. So looking at before doing films, writing, and running school programs for Americans coming to Nepal, and then we're very involved with the Upaya Zen Center and nomad clinics running medical expeditions, and also with Acupuncturists Without Borders. 3 years ago, we did trainings, and we was great with the Nepal Red Cross and Nepal Acupuncture Society, all on community trauma relief. There's something called the NADA protocol, and it's 5 points in the ear that you sit in a large group with people in silence, and it moves the body from the sympathetic into the parasympathetic, and it's very profound because you're experiencing it together as a community. And so I'm heading back in 2 days with two large duffel bags as we continue, especially to work with those on the front lines of the relief effort. They're exhausted. They've been at this since April 25th earthquake, and how do we can help to sustain and restore and keep them strong is really, really quite essential. So out of this work now comes the big questions. What is next and how does one reorient one's life. I ironically had just finished a degree at the Upaya Zen Center in trauma and resiliency, looking at the neuroscience of that. So now I have to take a big breath because we have, you know, 8 million people who've experienced this earthquake. And what I really feel is that rather than trying to apply Western psychological models to this, when one looks very deeply into the history and heritage, the tool chest that Nepalese have from both their Buddhist and their Hindu and their animist shamanic traditions is very, very rich. And with globalization and migration labor out of the country, these are tools now that maybe there's a reason that they'll become so helpful and evident and are so essential and critical at this time.
So in some way, then, maybe the earthquake has shook the core of what was maybe keeping Nepal stuck in some way. I mean, I'm trying to, if that's what I'm hearing you say, that through all of the strife with war and changes in government and religious changes, that the Nepalese population has kind of gotten lost in the crossfire of the influx of all the Western influence and Western tourism and trying to change with the times, that the quake maybe has shook off some of that and the people themselves are able to tap into what it is to be Nepalese.
That's what we hope, and we're seeing aspects of that. It's a very fragile and tenuous time period, of course. We're seeing some migrant laborers coming back from the Middle East and Malaysia to try to help. We would hope that some of the aid packages, the U.S. has been very generous, $26 million, for example, will help to be able to give people an honest wage so that they may be able to help to rebuild the country. Because with the devastation of the hospitals and the schools, et cetera, this is a 30-year project, mm-hmm. Really. And but let us hope that with this quake, as we say, there's a reawakening to what is most essential, what's most important. You know, so many, I remember so clearly, I was sitting right after the big earthquake with the community there, right? And we were all near the pond. And it was all of us as strangers, people hugging each other, little kids coming up close. And the desire to, you know, in Nepal, we say namaste. And namaste, you know, I don't know if anyone's, you ever see the funny jokes about in the whole earth or something where it's done as, you know, a very passive aggressive thing. There's a lot of teasing about how it's understood in American culture. But namaste is, you know, I bless the divine within you. Well, post-earthquake, people were looking at each other at the eyes, just happy to see a person was alive. And it had a greater significance. So in that sense of clearing away the veils of the Atman of who we really are out of this tragedy, I would hope that that's really that the Nepalese will be able to have a clarity of seeing what their strengths are. And from that, being able to rebuild, and hopefully some of the old and archaic, especially political structures that no longer serve them, will fall where the new young generation will be able to lead, because we've seen some very exciting grassroots process of that.
You're listening to Carol Dunham. She's a medical anthropologist and Buddhist chaplain and expedition leader from Nepal. She's been there for 30 years. And this is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Today, we aren't taking phone calls. We're just having a conversation in studio. But you can always be part of the conversation on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, and our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. And after the show today, we will post some information if you'd like to be able to help either financially or physically or spiritually, some ways you might be able to connect with those who are struggling to rebuild and to find their inner strength and resiliency. We'll have some links for you there. And you can also listen to previous shows by tuning into kcbx.org. And so, Carol, I'm fascinated about, you know, I just keep thinking of the metaphors and the imagery of having ourselves shook to the core and those old constructs that we've kind of been living under, to be able to have this moment in time to reinvent who you are as a culture and as a people. And I talk a lot on the show about when we look at help, is it either aiding or getting in the way of our own well-being? So being a Westerner, how do you view your part or Western efforts as aiding or getting in the way of the Nepalese people caring for themselves?
Oh, Bits, I really appreciate you asking that question, Elizabeth, because that's a really essential question and a question very close to the heart. I don't know if any of you have ever seen the book by Ram Dass. Do you remember the name of that? How Can I Help? And there's a real... Sometimes, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and you can sort of, you know, love a country to death. We see in Haiti where, you know, vast amounts of aid, and then what ended up happening at the very end, really helping folks to be resilient and on their own, even with the best intentions. Sometimes folks don't realize that there is a political or a power dynamic in who is the giver and who is the receiver. And Nepalese are proud and resilient people. They're saying, you know, just give us the tools and we can remanage it ourselves. I made very sure, as someone who'd been there for so long, I had to take a breather and say, well, you know, how can I best serve? What really is the best place for me? And I realized that in my position, I could use vast networks of 30 years and be able to try to coordinate and link people together so we could get the medical teams linked in with the food teams, linked in with the tarp and the tent people, try to make supplies to be able to come up from India, try the linking, which was critical so that things could happen. I wanted to be behind the scenes, not in front of the scenes, because this extraordinary beauty and tenuousness of watching this activation of the youth of Kathmandu, for example, mobilized, even the upper and the middle class, moving things out and linking to the rural areas in a way I've never seen in 30 years. And I didn't want to interfere with that process because there's something very colonial about saying, you know, we can help you. And then there's the sort of the victim or the recipient, and then there's the person who has all of the power and the power of the giving. And how do we actually support them to heal themselves? Mm-hmm. And the Nepalese really very much want to do that themselves. At the same time, how do we ensure, just like Afghanistan, that we're giving in the right places to the right people, where that we're not actually supporting older archaic power systems that perhaps would be better for the country if they withered and died? And I think that's where we've seen a lot in the media, a lot of confusion. And my strong encouragement is if you're looking at some of the grassroots organizations as well, are very, very valuable, where you get something direct and you can focus on a community for a long period of time.
So after 30 years as a resident, do you feel you are part of the inner community, or will you always be a Western visitor?
What I just said was that some people will think of me as, you know, as the whitey or the outside, and others will say that I'm Nepali. I have very close, you know, Nepali friends who joke and say, oh, you're more Nepali than we are. And in terms of, as someone who studied the history and the culture, the folklore that a lot of the young kids don't know and aren't interested in, Nepal has gone through such a tumultuous, in 30 years, it's lived, you know, it would be 300 years of history, process, and change in terms of going from, in terms of political changes and economic changes, a massacre. It's had a very, very colorful, intense period of time.
So, talk a little about that, because I don't know how many people really do know what these last 30 years have brought.
So when I first went to Nepal, there was a king, and there was only one newspaper that was governed by, we called it, it was the Rising Nepal. We used to joke and call it the Rising Nipple, and Queen Unveils Bust, and other kinds of wonderful headlines. And so there was a very centralization of power. It was panchayat. And so then what we saw was a movement towards democracy. We saw the rise of the Maoist movement and conflict. We had a massacre where the prince actually killed the entire royal family, including the father, at the palace. We then had his brother, who was not killed, took over, and there was huge there was not a lot of support for him, and he was finally taken down in 2006. And then we had we actually had an elected Maoist leader, Baburam Batrai, who took over as prime minister. And we still don't have a constitution yet. There's a lot of political tumult. So one crazy, you know, hope would be that that rather than everyone fighting over the potential of the aid money, we have a lot of, you know, the issue of scarce resources in desperate times right now, that perhaps we're seeing the best of humans and the worst of humans. So there are banditos at the border that are, there are political parties that are trying to take over the relief trucks so that they can distribute them, so they can be the big man. And this is where, you know, to come with a sense of humility and trying to listen and learn from Nepalese is a very, very important aspect. We also then have such extraordinary generosity, and we've seen some really extraordinary things that have emerged out of this tragedy. So our prayers would be that rather than being overwhelmed, because right now there's a real exhaustion. Mm-hmm. And how do we help as outsiders in that support is, particularly right now is emergency time period. People are trying to go as direct as possible for rice and tarps and shelter. And then we go through the long haul of reconstruction. And that's where it's going to get the creativity, as you were mentioning earlier, of how are they going to recover, pull from their very, very profoundly rich history and sense of heritage, and then choose what is most important as they move forward, as many of them, a large proportion of the country, has been migrant laborers working abroad. And so the economic questions, especially now as tourism also will be down, are very huge questions for the country.
So, I mean, it is literally a tipping point that can go one way or the other that you're in the middle of here. You're seeing the potential for great social change, the potential for great revisioning, recreating a story that these people tell of themselves or that you tell of yourself, or the fear of slipping back into old constructs, right? That if there's a power vacuum like there is right now, there's not really a strong leadership, it sounds like, in Nepal, because there isn't a Congress or a
They're elderly, you know, the current man in charge, unfortunately, you know, the government will let's wait and see. But what's really beautiful in a sense is that during the void of it is the ingenuity of getting around the government and being very creative, and people really sort of jury rigging from the real compassion in their hearts, real neighbor to neighbor activity, which really profound. I think that we're going to see coming out of this earthquake some new templates of possibilities in terms of how the social media was used to mobilize people, in terms of how they've been mapping the actual aid and relief and how it's getting out, and transparency for that. And so I think that we would hope, my great hope would be even that large, you know, disaster relief, we call it sometimes disaster capitalism as we have known it, may learn some very profound lessons out of the Nepal story here, and look at how we approach and how do they actually link to the grassroots. And the grassroots were much more mobile. They could respond far more faster, more quickly, using local resources. So how do we now fuse the small and the large into a way to really try to generate the larger essential and critical services necessary for the country to make it through?
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I'm in studio today talking with Carol Dunham, a resident of Nepal, about life post-quake and also in quake mode right now, because there are still many aftershocks and still people settling. And it's unfortunate that as soon as the media attention starts to wane on a subject, that the mindset of all the people starts to wane from the subject. It's hard to stay focused on something that's so far away, that's on the other, literally on the other side of the world. And also when in our own neighborhood, in our own backyards, we're worried about drought, we're worried about the economy, we're worried about our children and our government. I mean, throughout the world, our own little communities struggle with our issues. And one of the things you've talked about, you know, the idea of resiliency in the face of trauma, I keep thinking about the work we do as therapists, you know, that there's a very profound difference between empathy and sympathy. That when we're training therapists, we say you need to focus on empathy and remove sympathy, because sympathy victimizes the suffering, right? Those who are suffering. When we have sympathy, we feel badly for them and we victimize them and treat them as if they are not capable of caring for themselves. But empathy is that power structure, right? That power place where we can feel for someone, but we also feel for them in a way that we believe in their inner ability to heal and move forward and to find their own answers. And that really is the essence of therapy, is empathically supporting someone and making space for them to find their own inner wisdom. And I hear you talking about that experience in Nepal.
You know, it's interesting to add one, a Buddhist aspect to that. The Buddhists will discern the difference between empathy and compassion. And as valuable and important as empathy is, they would argue that there is a different aspect to empathy than to compassion, and that when we're empathetic, we also feel that pain. And whereas when we're compassionate, we're coming from a place of strength within our being, actually. We're not just being swamped by the suffering mm-hmm. of another, but we're allowing it, actually, it's our hearts are open with a sense of love that is a very, there's many aspects of compassion within a Buddhist perspective, but as it becomes stabilized, it becomes more steady and stable. And if one can gaze at the most horrific, even the very earthquake itself, all of the suffering, and even to oneself, and even to one's own suffering, from that deep place of compassion, rather than just empathizing with them, mm-hmm. but of generating out compassion, that has a strength of resiliency that is stronger than steel.
I wonder, you know, I was reading that those who are in Nepal through the Peace Corps and some of the agencies have been recalled back to the United States. And you talk about the desire to bring in the young and healthy and strong people to help rebuild. And so if we're pulling out our young, strong, care, heart-centered youth out of Nepal, who's going to be coming in? And why are we seeing this pullout when it seems like we should be?
Well, I'll, it's funny. I was walking with the Peace Corps director just 10 days before the earthquake. To be frank with you, we all asked the same question. We said we don't really understand why they're being pulled out. We need their help more than anything. But as I tried to mention earlier, on one hand, this very immediate phase or stage of it, the importance for Nepalese doing it for themselves actually has great and profound, is very, very important. And to be honest, and a lot of people don't realize that the tragedy, as much as like tourists have a very, you know, positive, people have been very welcome there. Even during the Maoist conflict, there was Westerners were never targeted. Sometimes the white face in this aid relief time period symbolizes great hidden wealth. Mm. And they assume that you have lots more that you could share if only you did. And so there were some incidences where there were villages very desperate, you know, people would, you know, throwing stones or very angry and aggressive. And I think that it's a phase of it. And once, you know, the relief, which we're still desperately going to, there'll be villages that are still haven't, you know, we're on day, you know, in the third and a half week of this tragedy, have not yet been serviced
been
accessed, correct. And there's going to have to be some evacuation of certain whole villages to be migrated down to the capital because of landslides, mm-hmm. et cetera. And so it's a matter of the timing. You know, I don't recommend anyone go there during the monsoon time period. The roads are very dangerous. The helicopters, I don't recommend flying in the monsoon time period. And right now, things are still shaking. So it's actually, you know, there was a whole group of rescuers that had to be evacuated.
It almost becomes more of the problem than the help.
You're taxing the system. So, you know, but let's wait by fall. By fall, we should be into the rebuilding time period. Mm-hmm. And at that time period, if you're strong and you're hardy and you feel that you're resilient yourself, you need to be in extremely great shape, because the most difficult to access villages are the ones that have the greatest need. And trying to bring relief or to bring support, to try to just help them and trying to rebuild, is something that they would be very grateful for. And that may really transform the relationship and the encounter as tourists, and be a very profound and meaningful thing.
So as we wrap things up today, are there a couple direct places you could send people to find out more or to be of help?
Yes. What I'd like to do is post things on your Facebook mm-hmm. page for a multiple of different options and opportunities for those that are interested in grassroots and those who are interested in education or in health.
And is there anything for those who can't access the internet or just listening on there who might immediately, is the Red Cross still a good venue?
Yes.
Or?
Red Cross is excellent. There's also SEVA is a great organization.
That's SEVA.
And there's WFP, which is the World Food Program. There's Oxfam. And there's WeHelpNepal.org is an example of a good small one. And Z Foundation for helping to rebuild schools.
And we've been speaking with Carol Dunham. She is a resident of Nepal. She's also a medical anthropologist, a Buddhist chaplain, and my cousin. And she has been in the studio today sharing her experiences with the current situation in Nepal. As always, we thank you for your support of this program. And you can find more information on my Facebook page, also the website, thereluctanttherapist.com. And we'll be podcasting this shows and all of our shows at kcbx.org. I look forward to speaking with you again next Tuesday at the same time. Until then, thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX.